Though a moment ago, he added with some severity, I feared an assistant peak-keeper would stumble into a snare set to catch a traitor. Would you serve me? Then return at once to the castle. Stay close by the princess.
Dare we let Mag go unhindered? Taran asked.
He must go unhindered for a time, at least, replied Gwydion. The shoemaker will soon put down his awl and take up the sword. Until then, keep silent. I would not spoil Mag's scheme before I learn more of it. The fisherfolk of Mona have already told a curious and harmless shoemaker part of what he must know, Gwydion continued. Enough to be certain of one thing. Akron is aboard that vessel. Yes, Gwydion went on as Taran drew a sharp breath. This much I suspected. Akron herself would not dare strike directly against Ailanwy. The castle is strong and well guarded. Only treachery could open its gates. Akron needed a hand to do her bidding. Now I know whose it is. Gwydion frowned deeply as he spoke on. But why? He murmured almost to himself. Too much still remains hidden. If it is as I fear. He shook his head quickly. It does not please me to use Ailanwy as unwitting bait for a trap, but I cannot do otherwise.
Mac can be watched, Taran said, but what of Akron?
I must find some means to learn her plan, as well as Mag's, replied Gwydion. Go quickly now, he ordered. Soon all may grow clear. So I hope, for I would not see the Princess Ailanwy long in peril.
Taran hastened to obey Gwydion's command. Leaving the Prince of Don at the harbour, he made his way with all speed up the winding path to the castle, found the opening in the wall, and pressed through it into the dark courtyard. Ailanwy, he knew, would not be safe so long as Mag had the freedom of the castle. But Mag, at least, could be watched. The terror that chilled Taran's heart came from the ship waiting in the night. Memory of Akron, beautiful and merciless, again returned to him. From a day long past he recalled her livid face, her voice that had spoken so softly of torment and death. It was her shadow that loomed behind the treacherous chief steward. He hurried silently across the courtyard. A dim light shone from one of the chambers. Stealthily, Taran moved toward it, raised himself on tiptoe, and peered through the casement. In the glow of an oil lamp, he saw the chief steward. Mag clutched a long dagger, which he brandished in the air, all the while making fierce grimaces. After a time, he hid the weapon in his garments, then picked up a small looking-glass, into which he smiled, pursed his lips, and eyed himself with glances of deep satisfaction. Taran watched with rage and horror, hardly able to keep from bursting in upon him. With a final smirk, the chief steward put out the lamp. Taran clenched his fists, turned away, and entered the castle. At Alanwy's chamber, he found Gergi crouched on the flagstones. Rumpled and half asleep, Gergi blinked and sprang to his feet. Kor, as tousled as Gergi himself, popped his head from under his wing.
All is quiet, Gergi whispered. Yes, yes, watchful Gergi has not moved from portal. Valiant, sleepy Gergi keeps noble princess from harmful hurtings. His poor, tender head is heavy, but he does not nod. Oh, no.
You have done well, Taran said. Sleep, my friend. Go and rest that poor, tender head of yours, and I shall stay here until daylight. While Gergi, yawning and rubbing his eyes, crept down the corridor, Taran took his place before the chamber. He sank to the flagstones and, with hand on sword, rested his head on his knees and fought against his own weariness. Once or twice, despite his efforts, he drowsed, then started up suddenly. The vaulted corridor slowly lightened in the rising dawn. With relief, Taran saw the first rays of morning and at last allowed himself to close his eyes.
Taran of Kaer Dalban!
He stumbled to his feet and clutched his blade. Ailanwy, looking fresh and well-rested, stood in the doorway.
"Taran of Kaer Dalban," she declared. "I nearly tripped over you. Whatever in the world are you doing?"
Befuddled, Taran could only stammer that he found the hallway more comfortable than his chamber. Ailanwy shook her head.
"That," she remarked, "is the silliest thing I've heard this morning. I may hear something sillier, because it's early yet, but I doubt it. I'm beginning to think the ways of assistant pig-keepers are quite beyond me. She shrugged. In any case, I'm going to breakfast. After you wash your face and untangle your hair, you might have some too. It would do you good. You look as jumpy as a frog with fleas.
Without waiting for Taran to shake the sleep from his head, and before he could stop her, Ailani disappeared down the corridor. Taran hurried after her. Even in the bright morning he felt shadows cling to him like black spider-webs. By now, he hoped, Gwydion had discovered Akron's plan. But Mag still went free. Taran, recalling the chief steward's hidden dagger, had no intention of letting Ailani out of his sight for an instant.
"Hello! Hello!"
His round face glowing as if he had just scrubbed it, Prince Roon popped out of his chamber just as Taran passed by.
"Going to breakfast?"
cried the prince, clapping Taran on the shoulder.
"Good, so am I."
"Then we shall meet in the Great Hall," Taran hastily replied, striving to shake himself loose from Roon's friendly grasp.
"Amazing how one's appetite grows during the night," Prince Roon went on. "Oh, by the way, did you ever manage to rouse the tailors?"
"Tailors?" Taran answered impatiently. "What tailors?"
"Oh, yes, yes, they have done what I asked," he quickly added, peering down the corridor.
"Splendid!" cried Roon. "I wish I had the same good fortune. Do you know, that shoemaker never did finish my sandals. He'd only just begun, then off he went, and that was the end of them."
"It may be he had a more important task to do," Taran replied. "As do I."
"What could be more important to a shoemaker than making shoes?" asked Roon. "However," he snapped his fingers, "ah, I knew there was something. I've forgotten my cloak. Hold on, I shall only be a moment."
"Prince Roon," Taran cried, "I must join the Princess Ailani."
"We shall be there directly," called Roon from the chamber. "Oh, drat, there goes my sandal lace broken. I do wish that shoemaker had finished his work."
Leaving the Prince of Mona still rummaging in the chamber, Taran sped anxiously to the Great Hall. King Rudlam and Queen Teleria were already at table, the Queen surrounded, as always, by her ladies. Taran looked quickly about him. Mag, usually in attendance, was not there. Nor was there any sign of Ailani. Chapter 5 The Oath.
"Where is Ailani?" Taran cried, as King Rudlam and Queen Teleria stared at him in astonishment. "Where is Mag? He's made off with her. Sire, I beg you, turn out your guard. Help me find them. Ailani is in danger of her life."
"What? What?" Queen Teleria clucked. "Mag? The princess? You're overwrought, young man. Perhaps the sea air—"
"Don't shake so and wave your arms about. Has gone to your head. Because someone isn't here for breakfast doesn't mean they're in danger, does it, my dear?" she asked, turning to the king.
"I should hardly think so, my dear," answered Rudlam. "This is a heavy charge to bring against a loyal retainer," he added, looking gravely at Taran. "Why do you accuse him?"
For a moment, Taran stood perplexed and torn. Gwydion had bound him to secrecy, but now that Mag had struck, must the secret still be kept? Taking his decision, he let the words tumble from his lips, hurriedly and often confusedly telling all that had happened since the companions had reached Dinas Ridnant. Queen Teleria shook her head.
"This shoemaker disguised as Prince Gwydion, or was it the other way around, and ships and torch signals to enchantresses make the wildest tale I've heard, young man."
"Wild indeed," said King Rudlam, "but we shall learn the truth easily enough. Fetch the shoemaker, and we shall soon see if he is the Prince of Don."
"Prince Gwydion seeks Akron," Taran cried. "I have given you the truth. If it is not so, you shall take my life for it. Will you prove my words? Fetch your chief steward."
King Rudlam frowned.
"It is odd that Mag should not be here," he admitted. "Very well, Taran of Caer Dalbyn. He shall be found, and you shall repeat your tale in his presence."
He clapped his hands and ordered a servitor to summon the chief steward. Frantic with anxiety, knowing that time was fleeting and delay could cost Ailani's life, Taran was nearly beside himself when the servitor at last returned with tidings that Mag appeared to be nowhere in the castle, nor could Ailani be found. As King Rudlam hesitated, still puzzled by Taran's words, Gergi, Kor, and Fluda entered the Great Hall.
Taran raced to them.
"Mag, that villainous spider!"
the bard exclaimed, as soon as Taran told him what had happened.
"Great Belin! She's ridden off with him. I saw them galloping through the gate. I called to her, but she didn't hear me. She seemed cheerful enough. I'd no idea anything was amiss. But they're gone, long gone by now."
Queen Teleria turned deathly pale. The ladies of the court gasped fearfully. King Rudlum sprang to his feet.
"You have spoken the truth, Taran of Caer Dalvin."
Shouting for the guard, the king strode from the great hall. The companions hastened after him. At King Rudlum's hurried orders, the stables were flung open. Within moments, the courtyard filled with warriors and neighing horses. Prince Rune, meantime, had strolled into the courtyard, where he peered at the gathering host.
"Hello, hello," he called to Taran. "Is this a hunting party? Splendid thought. I should enjoy a brisk morning ride."
"A hunt for your traitor steward," Taran retorted, thrusting Rune aside and making his way to King Rudlum. "Sire, where is your war leader? Give us leave to put ourselves at his service."
"My war leader, sorry to say, is none other than Mag himself," the king answered. "As we've never had a war on Mona, we never needed a war leader, and it seemed quite in order to give Mag the honorary title. I shall form up the searching party myself. As for you, yes, by all means help with any tasks that need doing."
While King Rudlum saw to the ordering of the warriors, Taran and the companions labored with all speed, tightening saddle girths and handing out weapons from the armory. Prince Rune, Taran saw, had clambered astride a sway-backed, piebald mare that persisted in turning in circles, despite the efforts of the prince to control her. Fluda and Gergi had led out three horses. A glance at the animals filled Taran with despair, for they seemed unspirited, of no great mettle, and he wished for the swift-footed Melinlass now grazing peacefully at Caer Dalvin. King Rudlum, taking Taran by the arm, drew him hurriedly into an empty stable.
"You and I must speak together," the king said quickly. "The warriors are ready and divided into two parties. One I shall lead over the land south of the River Alor. You and your companions are to ride with my son, who shall command the search in the hills of Paris, north of the Alor. It is of him I would speak."
"Prince Rune in command?" Taran burst out.
"What then, Taran of Caer Dalvin?" King Rudlum asked sharply. "Do you question Prince Rune's skill?"
"Skill?" Taran cried. "He has none. Ilanwi's life hangs in the balance. Our task must be done without delay. Give command to a feckless fool? He can barely knot a sandal lace, let alone ride a horse or wield a sword. The voyage to Mona showed me more than enough. Choose one of your liegemen, a warrior, a forester, anyone save Rune." He stopped short. "Dalvin has my oath to protect Ilanwi, and I say what is in my heart. Were I to say less, I would fail my duty. If I am to suffer for my words, then so be it."
"Once again you speak the truth," King Rudlum answered. "It is not you who suffers for it, but I."
He put a hand on Taran's shoulder.
"Think you I do not know my own son? You are right in your judgment. But I know, too, that Rune must grow to be both a man and a king. You carry the burden of an oath to Dalvin. I pray you take the burden of another one. Word of your deeds has reached Mona," King Rudlum went on, "and I have seen for myself that you are a brave lad, and honorable. I confide this knowledge to you. My master of horse is a skillful tracker. He rides with your party, and in truth shall direct the search. Prince Rune commands in name only, for the warriors expect leadership from the royal house. I would entrust my son to you, and beg you to let no harm befall him. Nor," added the king, smiling sadly, "to let him make too great a fool of himself. Much he has to learn, and much, perhaps, he may learn from you. One day he must be king of Mona, and it is my hope he will rule honorably and wisely, with Ilanwi, his queen."
"Ilanwi?" Taran cried. "With Rune, her husband?"
"Yes," answered King Rudlum. "When the princess comes of age, it is our desire they shall wed."
"Princess Ilanwi?" Taran murmured, confused. "Does she know of this?"
Not yet. Nor does my son, said King Rudlam. I learn we must have time to grow used to Mona and our ways here. But I am sure it will be happily arranged. After all, she is a princess and Roon is of royal blood.
Taran bowed his head. The grief in his heart kept him from speaking.
What say you, Taran of Caer Dalbyn?
King Rudlam asked.
Will you give me your word?
From the courtyard, Taran could hear the clamour of warriors and the voice of Fluda calling his name. Yet these sounds reached his ears as though from a great distance. He remained silent, his eyes downcast.
In this, I do not speak as liege lord to liege man, King Rudlam added. I speak as a father who loves his son.
He paused, watching Taran closely. At last, Taran met the king's eyes. I will swear this oath, he said slowly. Your son will come to no harm if it lies in my power to keep him from it. Taran put a hand to his sword. I pledge my life to do so.
Go with my thanks, Taran of Caer Dalbyn, King Rudlam said, and help us bring the Princess Ailanwy safely home.
The bard and Gurgi were already mounted when Taran hurried from the stable. Heavy-hearted, he swung into the saddle. Kor flew to join him. Prince Roon, who had finally managed to keep his steed from turning in circles, was shouting commands, unheeded as usual. As the searching parties galloped out the gates, Taran lifted Kor from his shoulder. Can you find her? Seek her carefully, my friend, he murmured, while the crow cocked his head and looked at Taran with shrewd eyes. Taran flung his arm upward. Kor launched himself into the air and sped aloft. Wings beating, the crows circled overhead, drove higher against the sky, then disappeared from sight.
Yes, yes, shouted Gurgi, waving his arms. Go with flyings and spyings. Lead us to evil, wicked steward. The sooner the better, cried Fluda. I can't wait to get my hands on that sneering spider. He shall know the fury of a flam.
Glancing behind him, Taran saw King Rudlam's band stream from the castle and turn eastward. Ahead, the Master of Horse led his party of warriors toward the higher ground above Dinas Ridnant and signaled for the outriders to search for tracks. Taran's face was set and grim as he rode silently next to Fluda.
Have no fear, the bard assured him. We shall bring Ailanwy back with us safe and sound before nightfall, and all of us shall make merry over this adventure. I promise you a new song in celebration.
You would do well to make it a chant of betrothal, Taran said bitterly, and sing of the wedding of the Prince of Mona.
Roon, cried the startled Fluda, to be wed? I had no idea. That's one disadvantage of being lodged in the stables instead of the castle. You miss the news and gossip. Prince Roon, indeed. Who is to be his bride?
Painfully, Taran told the bard of King Rudlam's plans and of his own oath to keep Roon from harm.
Oh, ho, said Fluda when Taran had finished. So that's the way the wind blows.
Strange, he added with a quick glance at Taran.
I had always hoped that if Ailanwy were betrothed to anyone, it would be... Yes, well, what I mean to say is that despite all the squabbling and bickering between the two of you, I had rather expected...
Do not mock me, Taran burst out, reddening. Ailanwy is a princess of the House of Lear. You know my station as well as I. Such a hope has never been in my mind. It is only fitting for Ailanwy to be betrothed to one of her own rank. Angrily, he drew away from the bard and galloped ahead.
So you say, murmured Fluda, hurrying after him. Look closer into your heart. You may find your opinion to be somewhat different.
Taran, unhearing, pressed his steed to join the line of warriors. Turning northward along the lower slopes of the hills of Paris, the searching party broke into smaller bands, each quartering its own ground. The warriors, widely separated, moved in long, wavering lines, often out of each other's sight, painstakingly scouting every possible hiding place. Yet, as the morning wore away and noontide passed, they found no trace of the chief steward or Ailanwy. Among the green and gentle slopes ran broken pebbly trails, where the fleeing mag might have passed and where clues would be invisible to the eyes of even the most able tracker. Taran's heart sank. In his mind chafed the fear that he was following a false hope, and that Ailanwy had been taken in an altogether different direction. From time to time, he anxiously scanned the sky for a glimpse of Kor returning with news of the princess. Gwydion, Taran knew, was the only one who might discover Akron's plan. Mag was the key. But the chief steward had acted so swiftly that perhaps even now he was beyond the reach of the searching party. Taran redoubled his efforts to find a broken twig, a loose stone, anything that might bring them closer to Ailanwy before nightfall put an end to the day's searching. Gurgi, riding close at hand, called out to him.
"Look, look! Noble Prince goes far alone, too far into the woods. He will lose himself. Then cheerful halloos will turn to sad moanings and groanings."
Taran, who had dismounted to study what seemed a possible trail, raised his eyes in time to see Prince Roon galloping over the shoulder of a hill. He shouted at him, but Roon was too distant to hear, or, more likely, Taran thought, was simply paying no heed. He leapt astride his horse and sought to overtake the prince. Until now he had managed to keep Prince Roon always in view, but by the time Taran reached the hill, Roon had vanished into the shadows of an alder grove. Below, on the rapidly darkening meadow, Fluda had cantered into sight and was calling him. Taran shouted Roon's name once again, then beckoned for the bard and Gurgi to join him.
"That sickening spider has escaped us today," Fluda cried angrily, while his nag labored to the crest. "But we shall fetch him out tomorrow, and Ailanwy will be safe and sound. If I know the princess, Mag has already begun to regret stealing her away. She's worth a dozen warriors, even if she's tied hand and foot."
Despite the bard's brave words, his face looked deeply worried.
"Come," said Fluda, "the master of horse is calling in the warriors. We're to make camp with them for the night."
Even as the bard spoke, Taran heard the faint notes of a signal horn. He frowned. "I dare not leave Prince Roon to wander alone in the forest."
"In that case," replied Fluda, glancing toward the setting sun, "we had best get hold of him without delay. A flam is keen-eyed. But I'd rather not go stumbling about the countryside after dark, if it can possibly be avoided."
"Hasten, yes, yes, with hurryings and scurryings," cried Gurgi. "Fearsome shadows fall, and bold but cautious Gurgi does not know what hurtful things hide in them."
The companions rode quickly into the grove, where Taran felt certain they would find the prince. However, once beyond the ring of alders, and seeing nothing of him, Taran's alarm grew. Vainly he called the prince's name. Only the echo returned.
"He cannot have ridden far," he told the bard. "Even Roon would have wits enough to halt at nightfall."
Darkness covered the grove. The horses, more used to their quiet stalls in Dinas Ridnant than to the forests of Mona, trod fearfully, rearing and shying at every wind-stirred bush. The companions were obliged to dismount and make their way on foot, leading the reluctant steeds. By this time, Taran was deeply troubled. What had begun as a simple matter had turned grave.
"He might have fallen from his horse," Taran said. "Even now he might be lying hurt or unconscious." "Then I suggest we find our way back to the rest of the band," said Fluda, "and ask them to help us. In this gloom, the more eyes, the better."
"We would lose too much time," Taran answered, pressing on through the underbrush. Gurgi followed, whimpering softly to himself. The rising ground told Taran they were moving above the foothills. No sound came but the hiss of saplings that whipped back as he passed, and the click of the horse's hooves over pale stones. Taran stopped short, his heart in his mouth. From a corner of his eye, he glimpsed a fleeting movement. It lasted but an instant, a shadow within a shadow. Fighting down his fear, he groped ahead. The horses had turned more skittish than before, and Taran's mount laid back his ears and voiced a frightened whinny. Gurgi, too, had sensed the dark presence. The terrified creature's hair rose along his neck, and he began to howl pitifully.
"Wicked, evil things come to follow harmless Gurgi. Oh, kind master, save Gurgi's poor tender head from hurtful dangers!"
Taran drew his sword, and the companions, with many backward glances into the darkness, hurried on. This time the horses did not lag, but plunged desperately ahead, nearly dragging the bard with them.
"Great Belin!"
protested Fluda, who had crashed into a tree and struggled to free his jangling harp from a bush.
"Hold up there! Next thing you know, we'll be looking for our own steeds as well as for Prince Roon."
With difficulty, Taran managed to calm the animals, who now refused to budge. Despite all his coaxing, pleading and tugging, the horses stood stiff-legged and round-eyed, their flanks trembling. Taran, himself exhausted, sank to the ground. "Our search is blind and useless," he said. "You are right," he went on, turning to Fluda. "We should have gone back. The time I had hoped to save is wasted twice over, and Ailanwy's danger is greater with every moment we delay. Now Prince Roon is lost, and so is Kor, for all we know."
"I'm afraid you're right," sighed Fluda. "And unless you or Gurgi knows where we are, I rather suspect we are lost, too."
Chapter 6 The Potions of Glue. At these words, Gurgi set up a wail and rocked back and forth, clutching his head. Taran swallowed his own despair as best he could and tried to reassure the frightened creature. "We can do nothing now but wait for dawn," Taran said. "The Master of Horse cannot be too far away. Find him as soon as you can. Above all, do not delay the search for Ailanwy. I shall seek Prince Roon," he added bitterly. "I have given my oath to keep him from harm, and I cannot do otherwise. But when I find him, I'll rejoin you somehow." He was silent then, his head bowed. Fluda was watching him.
"Do not wear out your heart with grief," the bard said quietly. "Mag can't escape us for long. I don't believe he means to harm Ailanwy, but only bring her to Akron, and we shall catch him long before he can do that. Rest now. Gurgi and I will share the watch."
Too weary to protest, Taran stretched out on the ground and covered himself with his cloak. No sooner did his eyes close than fears of Akron came to torment him. In rage and vengeance, the haughty queen would slay any of the companions who fell into her hands. And Ailanwy? He dared not let himself imagine her in Akron's grasp. When at last he dropped into fitful slumber, it was as though he slept beneath a millstone. The sun had barely risen when he opened his eyes with a start. Fluda was shaking him. The bard's yellow hair stood out raggedly in all directions. His face was pale with fatigue, but he grinned broadly.
"Good news," he cried. "Gurgi and I have done some seekings and peekings of our own. We're not as badly lost as you might think. The truth of it is, we've been thrashing around in a circle. Look for yourself."
Taran sprang to his feet and followed the bard to a low ridge. "You're right. There's the alder grove. It must be. And there, I remember the fallen tree where I lost sight of Roon. Come," he added, "we shall ride that far together. Then you must go ahead and catch up with the rest of the band." Hastily the companions mounted and urged their steeds toward the grove. Before they reached it, Taran's horse drew up sharply, then bore suddenly to the left. A loud whinny rose from the cover of trees along the shoulder of a hill. In astonishment, Taran slackened the reins and let the horse canter freely toward the sound. In another few moments, he glimpsed a pale shape beyond the foliage. As the steed carried him closer, he recognized Roon's piebald mare.
"See there," he called to Fluda. "Roon can't be far. We must have gone by him during the night."
Reining up, he leapt from the saddle. His heart sank. The horse stood riderless. At the sight of the other steeds, she raised her head, shook her mane, and whickered anxiously. Fearing the worst, Taran hurried past the mare, while Fluda and Gurgi dismounted and raced after him. He stopped short. Before him, in a clearing, stood something that looked at first like a huge, straw beehive. Fluda by then had come up beside him. Taran raised a hand in warning and moved cautiously toward the strange hut. The conical thatched roof, he now saw, had fallen away in many places. Rough stones, piled one on top of the other, formed a low side wall, a corner of which had collapsed into a heap of rubble. There were no windows, and the single heavy door hung askew from sagging leather hinges. He stepped closer. The holes in the thatch stared at him like empty eyes. Fluda glanced about him.
"I'm not too fond of going up and rapping on the door," he whispered, "and asking whoever's inside whether they've happened to see the Prince of Mona. Somehow it seems the kind of place even Roon would rather avoid. But I suppose there's no other way to find out."
Just then the door was flung open from the inside. Gurgi, with a yell, sought safety by scrambling up a tree. Taran's hand went to his sword.
"Hello, hello!"
Prince Roon, beaming, stood in the doorway. Aside from looking a little sleepy, he appeared quite himself and altogether unharmed.
"I hope you've got some breakfast with you,"
he added, rubbing his hands eagerly.
"I'm nearly starved to death.
Have you ever noticed how the fresh air sharpens one's appetite? Most surprising."
"Come in, come in,"
Roon went on, while Taran stared speechless at him.
"You'd be amazed how comfortable it is, surprisingly snug and cozy. Where did the rest of you pass the night? I hope you slept as well as I did. You can't imagine."
Taran could control himself no longer.
"What have you done?" he burst out. "Why did you leave the searching party? Count yourself lucky that getting lost was the worst that happened to you."
Prince Roon blinked and looked puzzled.
"Leave the searching party?" he asked. "Why, I didn't actually leave it. Not on purpose, you understand. It happened when I fell off my horse and had to go chasing after her all over nowhere, until I found her near this hut. By then it was getting dark, so I went to sleep. That's only common sense, wouldn't you say? I mean, why sleep outdoors when you can put a roof over your head? As far as being lost goes," Roon went on, "it seems to me you're the ones who got lost. Wherever I go, that's where the search is, if you see what I mean. After all, the one who's in command—"
"Yes, you command," Taran flung back angrily, "as you are born to, as a king's son."
He stopped abruptly. Another instant and he would have cried aloud his promise to King Rudlam and his oath to protect this witless prince. Taran clenched his teeth.
"Prince Roon," he said coldly, "you need not remind us we are under your orders. But for your own safety, I urge you to stay close to us." "And I advise you to stay away from strange huts," put in Fluda. "Last time I was in one, I almost got changed into a toad."
The bard shook his head.
"Shun them. Huts, that is," he added. "You never know what disagreeable thing you'll run into. And by the time you find out, it's too late."
"Changed into a toad?" cried Roon, not the least dismayed. "I say, that might be interesting. I should like to try it one day. But there's nothing like that to worry about. No one lives here, and they haven't for a long time."
"Hurry, then,"
Taran said, resolving never again to let Prince Roon out of his sight.
"We must join the others. We'll have long, hard riding before we catch up to them."
"Immediately,"
said Roon, who was wearing nothing but his shirt.
"I shall get my things together."
Gurgi, meanwhile, had clambered down from the tree. His curiosity getting the better of his prudence, he loped across the clearing and thrust his head into the doorway, at last venturing inside with Roon. Fluda and the impatient Taran followed him. It was, Taran saw, as the prince had told them. A heavy layer of dust covered the wooden tables and benches. A spider had spun an enormous web in one corner, but even the web was deserted. On a broken hearthstone lay the charred remnants of a long dead fire. Near the hearth, a number of large cookpots, dry and empty now, had been overturned. Earthen bowls and tall jars, shattered into fragments, were strewn about the floor. Through the holes in the roof, the leaves of more than one autumn had fallen, nearly burying a stool whose legs had broken into splinters. The hut was silent. The noises of the forest did not enter. Taran stood uneasily while Prince Roon fumbled with his gear. Gurgi, fascinated by so many strange odds and ends, lost no time in poking through them. Suddenly he cried out in surprise.
"Look! Look!"
he called, holding up a sheaf of tattered parchment. Taran knelt beside Gurgi and examined the ragged bundle. The field mice, he realized, had discovered the packet long before. Many of the sheets had been gnawed away, others were rain-sodden and blotted. The few undamaged pages were covered with cramped writing. Only at the bottom of the pile did Taran find pages in good repair. These had been carefully bound in leather to make a small tome, and their surface was clear and unmarked. Prince Roon, who still had not got around to buckling on his sword, came to peer over Taran's shoulder. "I say," he cried, "what have you there? I can't guess what it is, but it looks interesting. And isn't that a handsome little book? I shouldn't mind having it, to put down things I'm supposed to remember to do." "Prince Roon," Taran said, handing the undamaged volume to the Prince of Mona, who thrust it into his jacket. "Believe me, if there's anything that might ever help you do anything, you're welcome to it." He went back to puzzling over the parchments. "Between the mice and the weather," he went on, "there's not much to make out of this scroll. There seems to be no beginning or ending, but as far as I can tell, these are recipes for potions."
"Potions!" cried Fluda. "Great Belin, that's something we've little use for."
Taran, nevertheless, continued to scan and sort the pages. "Wait, I think I found the name of whoever wrote them. Glue, it looks like. And the potions, as it says here, are to—" his voice faltered, and he turned anxiously to Fluda. "To make yourself grow bigger. What can this mean?"
"How's that?" asked the bard. "Bigger? Are you sure you haven't read it wrong?"
He took the pages from Taran's hand and examined them carefully himself. When he had finished, he gave a low whistle.
"In my wanderings," said Fluda, "I've managed to learn a number of things, not least of which is don't meddle. I fear that's exactly what this fellow Glue did. Indeed, what he sought was a potion to make himself bigger and stronger. If those are Glue's boots over there," he added, pointing to the corner, "he surely needed one, for he must have been a little fellow."
Half hidden by leaves, a pair of well-worn boots lay on their side. They were hardly large enough to fit a child, and seemed to Taran pitiful in their smallness and emptiness.
"He must have been painstaking," Fluda went on. "I'll say that much for him. He describes everything he did, and set down all his recipes quite carefully and methodically. As for his ingredients," the bard said, making a sour face, "I should rather not think about them."
"I say," Prince Roon eagerly interrupted, "perhaps we should try them ourselves. It would be interesting to see what happens."
"No, no," Gurgi shouted. "Gurgi wants no tastings of nasty lotions and potions."
"Nor do I," said Fluda, "and neither did Glue, for the matter of that. He had no wish to drink his concoctions until he had some hope they'd work, for which I can't blame him in the least. He went about it very cleverly." "As I gather from what he's written down here," continued the bard, "he went out and trapped a mountain cat, a small one, I should think, since Glue himself was such a small person. He brought her back, put her in a cage, and fed her his potions as fast as he could cook them up."
"Poor creature," said Taran.
"Indeed," agreed the bard, "I shouldn't have liked to be in her place. Yet he must have grown fond enough of her to give her a name. Here, he's written it down. Lian. Apart from feeding her those dreadful messes, I expect he didn't treat her badly. She might even have been company for him, living alone as he did." "At last it happened," Fluda went on. "You can see by his writing how excited Glue must have been. Lian began to grow.
Glue mentions he was obliged to make a new cage for her. And still another. How pleased he must have been. I can easily imagine the little fellow chuckling and brewing away for all he was worth.
Fluda turned to the last page.
"And so it ends," he said, "where the mice have eaten the parchment. They've done away with Glue's last recipe. As for Glue and Leanne, they've vanished along with it."
Taran was silent, looking at the empty boots and overturned cookpots. "Glue certainly is gone," he said thoughtfully, "but I have a feeling he didn't go far."
"How's that?"
asked the bard.
"Oh, I take your meaning," he said, shuddering. "Yes, it does look rather, shall I say, sudden? As I see Glue, he was a neat and orderly sort. He would hardly go off leaving his hut, as it is now. Without his boots at that. Poor little fellow," he sighed. "It only proves the dangers of meddling. For all his pains, Glue must have got himself gobbled up. And if you ask me, the wisest thing for us is to leave immediately."
Taran nodded and rose to his feet. As he did, terrified whinnyings and the sound of galloping hooves filled the air.
"The horses!" he cried, racing to the door.
Before he could reach it, the door burst from its hinges. Taran clutched at his sword and stumbled back into the hut as a huge shape leapt at him. Chapter 7 The Lair of Leanne. Taran's blade went spinning from his grasp, and he threw himself to the ground to escape the onslaught. In a powerful spring, the creature passed over his head. The great beast screamed with fury as the companions scattered in terror to all parts of the hut. Amid the confusion of tumbling stools and benches, and as the dry leaves rose in a whirlwind, Taran saw that Fluda had jumped to a tabletop and, in so doing, had plunged into the spider-web which now covered him from head to foot. Prince Roon, having tried vainly to climb up the chimney, crouched in the ashes of the hearth. Gurgi had made himself as small as he could and had pressed into a corner, where he squealed and yelled,
"Help! Oh, help! Save Gurgi's poor tender head from pawings and clawings!"
"It's Leanne!" cried Taran.
"You can be sure it is," Fluda shouted. "Now that I see her, I quite believe Glue was gobbled up and digested long ago."
A long, wavering growl rose from the creature's throat, and she hesitated a moment, as if undecided where to attack. Taran, sitting up on the ground, saw for the first time what the ferocious animal looked like. Though Glue had written of Leanne's growth, Taran had never imagined a mountain cat so big. The animal stood as tall as a horse, but leaner and longer. Her tail alone, thicker than Taran's arm, seemed to take up much of the room in the hut. Heavily and sleekly furred, the cat's body was golden tawny, flecked with black and orange. Her belly was white with black splotches. Curling tufts sprouted from the tips of her ears, and shaggy handfuls of fur curved at her powerful jaws. Her long whiskers twitched. Her baleful yellow eyes darted from one companion to another. Judging from the white points of her teeth, glittering as her lips drew back in a snarl, Taran was certain Leanne could gulp down anything that suited her fancy. The giant cat swung her great head toward Taran and moved lithely across the ground. As she did, Fluda unsheathed his sword. Cobwebs and all, he jumped from the table, shouted at the top of his voice, and brandished the weapon. In an instant, Leanne spun around. The lash of her tail sent Taran headlong once more. Even before Fluda could strike, Leanne's heavy paw flickered through the air. Its motion was too rapid for Taran's eyes to follow. He saw only the astonished bard's weapon fly up and clatter into the doorway, while Fluda himself went head over heels. With a snort and what seemed a shrug of her rippling shoulders, Leanne turned again to Taran. She crouched, thrust out her neck, and her whiskers trembled as she padded closer to him. Taran, not daring to move a muscle, held his breath. Leanne circled him, making snuffling noises. From the corner of his eye, Taran glimpsed the bard trying to climb to his feet, and warned Fluda to stay still.
"She's more curious than angry," Taran whispered. "Otherwise she would have clawed us to pieces by now. Don't move. She may go away." "Glad to hear you say that,"
replied Fluda in a choked voice.
"I'll remember it while I'm being gobbled up. It will be a consolation to me."
"I don't think she's hungry," said Taran. "If she's been out hunting during the night, she must have eaten her fill."
"So much the worse for us," said Fluda. "She'll keep us here until her appetite comes back. I'm sure this is the first time she's been lucky enough to have 4 dinners ready and waiting in her lair."
He sighed and shook his head.
"In my own realm, I was always putting out scraps for birds and other creatures, but I never thought I'd see the day when I'd be putting myself out, if you take my meaning."
At last, Lian settled herself across the doorway. She moistened a huge paw with her tongue and began passing it over her ear. Engrossed in her task, she seemed to have forgotten the companions were there. Despite his fear, Taran could not help staring at her in fascination. Power filled even Lian's gentlest movements. Beneath the golden fur, glowing in the sunlight from the open door, he could guess at her mighty muscles. Lian, he was certain, could be swift as Melinless. But he knew also she could be deadly, and though she did not appear ill-disposed toward the companions, her mood might change at any instant. Taran cast about desperately for a way to freedom, or at least a means of regaining their weapons.
"Fluda," he whispered, "make a little noise, not too much, but enough so that Lian will look at you." "How's that?" asked the bard, puzzled. "Look at me? She'll do that soon enough. I'm thankful she hasn't yet got around to it."
However, he scraped his boots across the floor. Lian immediately pricked up her ears and turned her eyes on the bard. Crouching, Taran moved silently toward Lian, his hand outstretched. His fingers cautiously reached for his sword, which lay close to Lian's paws. Quick as lightning, the mountain cat struck at him and he fell back. Had her claws been unsheathed, Taran realized with a sinking feeling, Lian would have gained his head in addition to his weapon.
"No chance, my friend," said Fluda. "She's faster than any of us." "We can be hindered no longer," Taran cried. "Time is precious." "Oh, indeed it is," the bard answered, "and gets more precious the less of it we have. I'm beginning to envy Princess Ailanbi. Mag may be a foul, villainous spider and all such as that, but when it comes to teeth and claws, I should vastly prefer going against him instead of Lian." "No, no," he sighed. "I'm quite content to stretch my last moments as far as they'll reach."
Taran, in despair, pressed his hands against his forehead.
"Prince Roon,"
he called softly after a moment, as Lian began passing a paw over her whiskers.
"Stand up quietly. See if you can make your way to that broken corner of the hut. If so, climb out and run for your life."
The Prince of Mona nodded, but no sooner had he risen to his feet than Lian growled a warning. Prince Roon blinked and quickly sat down again. Lian glared at the companions.
"Great Belin," whispered Fluda, "don't rouse her up any more. It will only bring on her appetite. She's not going to let us out of here. That's one thing sure."
"But we must escape," Taran urged. "What if we all rushed upon her at once? One of us at least might get past." Fluda shook his head.
"After she'd settled with the rest of us," he answered, "she'd have no trouble catching up with that lone survivor. Let me think, let me think."
Frowning, he reached behind him and unslung his harp. Lian, still growling, watched intently, but made no further move.
"It always calms me," explained Fluda, putting the instrument against his shoulder and passing his hands over the harp strings. "I don't know whether it will stir up any ideas, but when I'm playing, at least things don't seem quite so dismal."
As a soft melody rose from the harp, Lian began making a peculiar noise.
"Great Belin," cried Fluda, stopping immediately. "I almost forgot about her. It may be calming for me, but who can tell what it might do to a mountain cat?"
Lian now voiced a strange, pleading yowl. But seeing Fluda about to sling the harp on his shoulder once again, her tone changed and sharpened. She growled menacingly.
"Fluda," Taran whispered, "play on." "You can't think she enjoys it,"
replied the bard.
I should find that hard to believe. Why, even human beings have been known to say hard words about my music. You can't expect a mountain cat to like it any better.
Nevertheless, he plucked the strings once more. This time, there was no doubt in Taran's mind that Lian was fascinated by the harp. The great body of the cat slackened, her muscles seemed to uncoil, and Lian blinked peacefully. To make certain, Taran asked Fluda to stop. As soon as the bard did so, Lian turned restless. Her tail lashed, and her whiskers trembled with what could only be vexation. As soon as the bard played again, Lian put her head to one side, ears forward, and gazed fondly at him.
"Yes, yes," Gurgi cried. "Do not leave off hummings and strummings."
"Believe me," the bard answered fervently, "I haven't the slightest intention."
Lian folded her paws under her deep, speckled chest and began making a sound like a swarm of droning bees. Her mouth curved in a smile, and the tip of her tail moved gently to the music.
"That's the answer," cried Fluda, springing to his feet. "Fly, friends, while she's quiet."
No sooner had he risen than Lian, too, jumped up, furious, and the bard sank back, playing for dear life.
"Your music calms her," Taran cried in alarm. "But she still won't let us go." "Not exactly," said the bard, passing his fingers rapidly across the strings. "I doubt if the rest of you will have any trouble. Alas," he added ruefully, "I fear I'm the one she wants to keep."
Chapter 8 The Harp of Fluda.
"Fly from here," urged the bard, never ceasing to pluck his harp strings. "Begone. I've no idea how long she'll want to listen, or how long I can keep playing."
"There must be another way," Taran cried. "We can't leave you."
"I like it no more than you do," replied the bard. "But this is your chance. You must take it now."
Taran hesitated. Fluda's face was grim and drawn, and he seemed already weary.
"Begone," Fluda repeated. "I'll play as long as I can. By then, if she's decided not to gobble me, she may go out hunting. Don't worry. If the harp fails, I'll think of something else."
Sick at heart, Taran turned away. Lian lay on her side across the threshold, one paw outstretched, the other gently curled against her tawny body. Her neck arched, and her huge head turned toward Fluda. The fierce creature seemed altogether comfortable and peaceful. With yellow eyes half closed, she watched only the bard as Taran stealthily moved to join Gurgi and Prince Roon. Taran's sword remained with the other weapons beneath her paw, and he dared not attempt to snatch it away, fearful as he was of breaking the spell of Fluda's harp. The fallen stones at the corner of the hut gave a narrow passage into the clearing. Taran motioned hurriedly for the prince to go through. Gurgi followed on tiptoe, eyes wide with fright. He clutched his jaws in both hands to keep his teeth from chattering. Taran still hung back, and turned once more to the bard, who gestured frantically.
"Out! Out!" commanded Fluda. "I shall find you as soon as I can. Did I not promise you a new song? You shall hear it from my own lips. Until then, farewell."
Fluda's tone and glance left no room for question. Taran flung himself past the stones. In another instant, he was free of the hut. As Taran feared, the horses had broken their tethers and fled at the sight of Lian. Gurgi and Prince Roon had crossed the clearing and vanished into the forest. Racing at top speed, Taran soon caught up with them. Rune's pace had already begun to flag, his breathing was labored, and he looked as though his legs might give way at any moment. Taran and Gurgi caught the staggering prince and bore him along as fast as they could. For some while, the three struggled through the underbrush. The forest had begun to grow sparser, and Taran caught sight of a broad meadow. At the edge of the flatland, he halted. Prince Rune, he knew, had reached the end of his strength, and he hoped only that they were a safe distance from Lian. The Prince of Mona gratefully dropped to the turf. "I shall be up and about in a moment," he feebly insisted. His face was pale and drawn beneath its coating of soot, yet he tried valiantly to assume his usual cheerful grin. "Amazing how running seems to tire one. I'll be glad when we find the master of horse and I can ride again. Taran did not answer immediately, but looked closely at Rune. The Prince of Mona bowed his head.
I can guess what you're thinking, Rune said in a low voice. If it hadn't been for me, you wouldn't be in this plight, and I'm afraid you're right. It's my fault things turned out as they did. I can only ask your forgiveness. I'm not the cleverest person in the world, Rune added, smiling sadly. Even my old nurse used to say I was all thumbs. But I hate being a blunderer. It's not what people expect of a prince. I didn't ask to be born into the royal house. That, at least, wasn't my doing. But since I was, I want very much to be worthy of it.
If you want to, then you shall, Taran answered, suddenly and strangely touched by the Prince of Mona's frankness, and not a little ashamed of his own unkind thoughts about Rune. I ask your own forgiveness. If I envied your rank, it was because I believed you held it as a lucky gift and took it for granted. You speak the truth. For a man to be worthy of any rank, he must strive first to be a man.
Yes, that's what I mean, Rune said eagerly. That's why we must rejoin the Master of Horse as soon as we can, don't you see? In this I'd hope not to fail. I want to be the one who finds Princess Ailanwy. After all, I'm to be betrothed to her.
Taran looked at him in astonishment.
How do you know this? I had thought only your parents. Oh, there have been rumours around the castle, replied Rune, and I sometimes hear a little more than I'm supposed to. I knew there was a betrothal in the wind even before I was sent to bring Princess Ailanwy to Mona.
Ailanwy's safe return is all that matters now, Taran began. He spoke slowly, knowing in his heart that he, no less than Rune, yearned to be Ailanwy's rescuer. But he realized there was a decision he must face without flinching. The searchers, by this time, are far distant, Taran said, each word costing him an effort, yet each word forcing him to a choice as painful as it was clear. Without horses, we cannot hope to reach them. Continuing our own search on foot would be too hard and too dangerous. We have only one path to follow, the one that will lead us back to Dinas Ridnant.
No, no, Rune cried. I don't care about the danger. I must find Ailanwy.
Prince Rune, Taran said gently, I must also tell you this. Your father asked for my oath, and I have given it to keep you from harm. Rune's face fell.
I might have guessed as much. Certainly I knew from the beginning, no matter what my father said about putting me in command, I wasn't really leading. No more than I am now. I understand. I'm under your orders. Whatever's to be done, you are the one to decide.
There are others who can finish the task, Taran said. As for us...
See, what lookings!
Burst out Gergi, who had been crouching near a fallen ash tree.
See, comings with chasings and racings!
He waved his arms excitedly and pointed to a low ridge. Taran made out a figure running at top speed, his harp bouncing at his shoulder, his cloak rolled up and clutched under one arm, and his lanky legs pumping for all they were worth. The bard dashed down the slope. He flung himself to the ground and mopped his streaming face.
"Great Belin!" Fluda gasped. "I'm glad to see all of you again."
From his cloak he drew out the lost swords and handed them to the companions.
"And I think we shall all be glad to see these."
"Are you wounded?" Taran asked. "How did you escape? How did you find us?" Still puffing, the bard raised a hand.
Give me a moment to catch my breath, for I lost it somewhere along the way. Wounded? Well, yes, in a manner of speaking, he added, glancing at his blistered fingers. But I had no trouble finding you. Rune must have carried off all the ashes in Glue's fireplace. I could hardly miss the trail.
As for Lian, Fluda went on, the bards will sing of that, you can be sure. I must have played, sung, whistled and hummed everything I ever knew, and twice over.